Hello and welcome to A Closer Look at the Evolving Landscape of Medicaid Waivers, a web briefing for journalists presented by the Kaiser Family Foundation. Today's conference is being recorded, and at this time I'd like to turn the conference over to Mr. Chris Lee of the Kaiser Family Foundation. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, operator. Again, I'm Chris Lee. I'm a communications officer here. I've probably dealt with many of you via email or on the phone. Thanks so much for joining us for this look at Medicaid waivers and what's going on in the current landscape. It's a very active topic. 23 waivers pending in 22 states, lots of approved waivers. Some of the areas that are getting lots of attention are work requirements, premiums, benefit restrictions, eligibility and enrollment restrictions. We're joined today by two of our top experts here at Kaiser, Robin Rudowitz and Mary Beth Musumeci. They are both associate directors of the Foundation's program on Medicaid and the uninsured. I should remind you that this web briefing is being recorded. The archive recording and the slides will be posted on kff.org probably later today or no later than tomorrow. This is a listen-only format. You can ask questions of our panelists by using your chat function, and we'll get to them a little bit later in the briefing. And first, I'd like to turn to Robin and let her talk a little bit about what's going on.
Thanks, Chris, and good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for tuning in today. There is, as Chris said, certainly a lot going on with Medicaid demonstration waivers. This webinar is designed to provide a closer look at what these waivers are, how they've been used, and explain how the landscape of these waivers is evolving. I'm going to provide a bit of an overview and then turn to Mary Beth, who'll jump in and provide some more specifics about Kentucky, which may be a model for how the administration is viewing waivers going forward. I will provide a warning in advance that there's a lot of information in the slides, much of which can be found in our new waiver landscape paper and on our waiver tracker, which is updated regularly. We're not going to go through every point on the slides or try to explain waivers in each state, but the slides are meant to serve as a resource, and I'm going to cover some main points. So first, I wanted to start off with some basics, mainly what is a waiver. So Section 1115 of the Social Security Act provides authority for HHS to grant waivers to allow states basically to do something that they can't do under current federal Medicaid rules, as long as the state is testing something through a demonstration, project, or pilot. The demonstration must be likely to assist in promoting the objectives of the Medicaid program. It has to be budget neutral to the federal government over the course of the waiver. It also is subject to state and federal public notice and comment periods. Each administration has used waivers in the past and has discretion over which waivers to approve and encourage. However, that discretion is not unlimited. The Trump administration has issued some new waiver guidance, namely on November 7th, there was new waiver approval criteria that was posted, and most notably, compared to previous criteria, the new criteria no longer includes increased coverage as one of the approval criteria components. And then more recently, on January 11th, new guidance on work requirements or community engagement waivers was posted. These new policies are recasting Medicaid as more in line with welfare program rules compared to the direction of aligning Medicaid with other health coverage programs as was envisioned under the ACA. It's also clear that these new policies will definitely test the bounds of administrative discretion on how waivers can be used. There's a lot of attention going on about waivers right now, but we also want folks to understand that waivers really aren't new to the program. They've been part of the program since the beginning. Waivers gained more widespread use during the mid-1990s when states began using savings from managed care or redirecting disproportionate share hospital payments to implement broad coverage expansions. Again, waivers have been used under previous administrations, the Bush administration as well as the Obama administration. Throughout the history of waivers, the focus has generally been on expanding coverage to new people. So this slide really shows, again, how common waivers are. They're used in most states, as Chris mentioned, as of today, and these counts will likely change as of later today, after 2:30. But there are 34 states that have 42 approved waivers, and 22 states have 23 pending comprehensive 1115 waivers. We have grouped them into these eight categories, as you can see in the bars. Starting with the first bar on the left, we can see that eight states have approved waivers to implement the ACA Medicaid expansion. For seven of these states, the waiver was adopted at the same time as the state adopted the Medicaid coverage expansion. For Kentucky, the most recent expansion waiver, the state transitioned expansion coverage from a state plan amendment to a waiver. And again, Mary Beth will provide more details about that Kentucky waiver in a bit. I'm going to really focus on the next three bars and dig a little bit deeper into what types of waivers are being approved and pending around eligibility and enrollment, work requirements, and benefits, copays, and healthy behaviors. So as noted earlier, seven states had newly implemented the ACA Medicaid expansion through a waiver. For some of these states, those waivers included some eligibility and or enrollment restrictions relative to current law in exchange for the new coverage. For example, Medicaid law generally restricts the use of premiums for enrollees with incomes below 150% of poverty. Some waivers were granted to allow new expansion states to charge premiums particularly targeted to individuals with incomes between 100 to 138% of the poverty level, and that would be similar to premiums that they may have faced if they had received marketplace coverage. With the approval of Kentucky and looking at the pending waivers, we definitely see a bit of a change in that landscape. First, we see eligibility restrictions that would be applicable to current expansion populations as well as traditional Medicaid populations. And we're also seeing some eligibility restrictions that have never been approved before, like lockouts for failure to timely renew or report changes in income. There are also a number of waivers pending that would impose new eligibility restrictions that have never been approved before, again, on current populations, both expansion populations as well as traditional populations. Again, I'm not going to go through every one on this list, but I wanted to highlight a few of the more fundamental changes that states are requesting. There are two states that have waivers pending to limit expansion eligibility to 100% of the poverty level and still receive the enhanced match. One state has a waiver pending to allow for drug testing as a condition of Medicaid eligibility, and five states have waivers pending to impose time limits on Medicaid coverage. As we mentioned earlier, on January 11th, CMS issued new guidance related to work requirements or community engagement in Medicaid as a condition of eligibility. This action reversed previous policies by both Democratic and Republican administrations. One day following the release of the guidance, CMS approved the pending waiver in Kentucky that included a work requirement, and there are nine states with pending requests. Similar to eligibility changes, states are seeking to impose these work requirements on both current expansion populations as well as traditional populations, including some states with very low Medicaid eligibility like Mississippi. A number of states have also received approval or are seeking approval for waivers that would affect benefits, copays, and healthy behavior programs. Some of these pending provisions have not been approved in other states, like the use of a closed formulary pending in Massachusetts, or imposing restrictions on the choice of family planning providers that's pending in Texas. So with all these states seeking waivers, what do we know about the experience in states that have implemented the waivers, and what does the research and data tell us about waivers? So we had looked and done some case study work in Michigan and Indiana looking at early implementation of the waivers and drew a few lessons to be learned from other states. First, Medicaid expansion design really depends on the features of a state's underlying Medicaid program. So, for example, in Indiana, HIP 2.0 really built on HIP 1.0. So that type of waiver might not work in another state because it was building on a previous waiver. Implementation of complex programs involves a lot of collaboration with a variety of stakeholders, the state, plans, providers, beneficiaries, and it also requires a lot of sophisticated IT systems and additional administrative costs. Premium costs and complex enrollment policies can deter eligible people from enrolling in coverage. Some of the policies can be confusing to beneficiaries, and provider education and beneficiary education is necessary. And with regard to healthy behavior programs, tangible incentives appear to be central to making those programs work. There was just some new data posted for Indiana, and this shows that for the third quarter, the state reported that there were 45,000 disenrolled from coverage or closures to enrollment. Just under one in three of those closures was due to failure to comply or complete redeterminations. Under current law, many individuals may miss a renewal date but would not be locked out of coverage. If they're eligible, they could reapply. But there are pending changes in Indiana that could impose a lockout for failure to timely renew, which could result in coverage losses among many who might be eligible. Another 7% of closures were due to failure to pay the monthly contributions as required in the state's current waiver. May seem like a small share of those closures, but it's important to remember that that requirement only applies to a small share of the population covered in Indiana, between 100 and 138% of poverty. There's also a lot of discussion about work requirements. As states contemplate these waivers, it's important to examine the data that show most Medicaid enrollees are working or face significant barriers to work. This leaves a small segment of the population for whom these policies may be directed. However, these policies could affect most enrollees, as those who are working would need to document their work status, and others might need to navigate a difficult process to obtain an exemption from the requirement. In addition, nationally and in almost all of the states seeking work requirements, many non-elderly Medicaid adults have a disability but do not receive SSI. So these individuals could be subject to the work requirements or, again, would have to navigate a process to qualify for an exemption. There's a lot that we can learn from the TANF experience with work requirements as states seek to impose these on Medicaid. The research shows that coverage through Medicaid supports enrollees' ability to work. Many of the jobs held by enrollees do not offer health insurance. Addressing barriers to work requires adequate funding and supports, and implementing work requirements can create administrative complexity, which again can result in loss of coverage for individuals who remain eligible. There's also a large body of evidence that shows the effects of imposing premiums and cost sharing on individuals with low income. These generally result in decreases in enrollment and renewals, as well as increased financial barriers for individuals, and declines in the use of needed services. States also see limited savings and increased administrative costs related to these policies. So many of these provisions related to premiums, particularly related to premiums and work requirements, require increased documentation and new administrative burdens for individuals. And these increased documentation requirements really run counter to the application and enrollment streamlining that was required under the ACA, that really all states had to adopt these new policies. So that is sort of a nutshell overview, and now I'm going to turn it over to Mary Beth to talk more about Kentucky.
Thanks, Robin. And I will reiterate, as Robin said at the beginning, that we are not going to go through every single detail on these slides, as you're going to see. The Kentucky waiver in particular is very complicated, but we just wanted to point out some highlights of some key provisions that you might want to look at, and starting with this slide to highlight some of the things that were never approved before in Kentucky. So Kentucky has some similarities to Indiana in that its waiver, or the bulk of its waiver, applies to its expansion adults as well as some other traditional populations like low-income parents. Kentucky is distinct among the expansion waivers because it's the first state that got a waiver not to do a new expansion, but rather to make changes in coverage after it had already implemented a traditional expansion. And this slide flags provisions that were approved for the first time. So other states have premiums, but the premium levels in Kentucky can go up to 4% of income. These are the highest premiums that have been approved in Medicaid. It exceeds the 2% of income limit in other waivers approved to date, as well as the 2% limit for individuals in the marketplace at that income level. Kentucky also is the first state to have a work requirement as a condition of eligibility, which we'll talk more about in a later slide. And in addition to the lockout for failure to pay premiums, Kentucky has two other lockouts for 6 months for failure to timely report changes in income or to renew coverage. I also wanted to flag a couple of more logistical changes in Kentucky's waiver. There are provisions that leave it up to the state as to whether operational protocols will be submitted to CMS. These are the details that will work out how, for example, the premiums will be implemented that other states have had to submit for approval to CMS, but this is optional in Kentucky. And there's also a provision that says the state can change the terms of the waiver if the secretary determines they're of an operational nature without putting them out for public notice and comment. And I also just wanted to footnote that there's another part of Kentucky's waiver that applies to substance use services. Indiana also has some similar provisions in its extension request. And so if there are questions, we can talk about that, but we're really going to focus on the eligibility enrollment restriction part of the waiver. So this diagram gives you a sense of how people who are newly applying can come into coverage. And the key thing to understand here is that this changes baseline federal Medicaid law. So normally under Medicaid, once you're determined eligible, your coverage is effective. And Kentucky has a rule in place that's similar to Indiana, which requires people to first pay a premium to effectuate their coverage. For people who are above poverty, you cannot get coverage unless and until that premium is paid. For people below poverty who can't pay or don't pay their premium, you wait for the 60-day payment period to expire before coverage is effective. And then this slide illustrates the consequences for not paying your premium once you are enrolled. So, for people above poverty, you're disenrolled with an up to 6-month lockout if you don't pay your premium. For those under poverty, you are enrolled, but your benefits look a little bit different. And in Kentucky, there's a distinction that's the most important distinction is for expansion adults under poverty. If you don't pay a premium and you're an expansion adult in Kentucky, you don't have access to a rewards account, which is where your healthy behavior incentive dollars accrue, and that's how you would get access to your dental and vision and some other extra benefits. To give you an idea of what the premium levels look like, so we've been talking about 4% of income, but what does that really look like? We've pulled out some of the poverty levels for different household sizes and then what the equivalent premium would be. So for most people, a $20 per month premium may not sound like that much, but that's the maximum level for someone at 50% of the poverty level, and that means that a household of one has an income of about $500 a month. The premium levels become more meaningful because if you don't pay, you don't get coverage at all for people once they're above the poverty level. So that's for people with a little over $1,000 a month, could pay up to $40 in order to activate and keep their coverage. And then the maximum at 138% of poverty, so of just under $1,400 a month, you're looking at a 4% of income premium at $56. Kentucky has two different accounts that folks will have to keep track of. So similar to Indiana, it has this deductible account where the state will put money in to fund non-preventative services, and if money's left over, then at the end of the year, that's one way you can fund your incentive account to get your extra benefits like vision and dental. So the incentive account is called My Rewards, and it's a separate account that people will have to keep track of in Kentucky. We don't know a lot of the details about how this will be implemented, but basically there will be activities that people can do to accrue dollars. So if you complete certain healthy behaviors, if you don't go to the emergency room for a non-emergency visit, and then there'll be other activities where you'll be subject to losing dollars from your account. So if you miss an appointment, if you have an emergent ER visit. So what those dollar figures will be and how they add up to the fee-for-service rates to actually access dental and vision services is another issue that will be important to understand when this is implemented. This slide looks at the work requirements, and you can get an idea of what the approved activities are in Kentucky. This is pretty consistent with the January 11th guidance that CMS put out for states interested in designing this type of a waiver. And so the important thing to remember is that, as Robin mentioned, it's not just meeting the requirements, but it's also documenting or verifying each month that you've met the requirement of 80 hours, or alternatively, if you meet an exemption, verifying that you meet that exempt status. But you could meet the requirement by working or working in some other combination of these different activities that include job search and job training, caretaking, either for a non-dependent relative or another person with a disabling condition, and substance use disorder treatment is also a qualifying work activity. The right-hand side of the slide shows some of the things that the state is obligated to do under the waiver. So there's language in the waiver that says the state has to make good faith efforts to connect people with available support, such as subsidized childcare, transportation, language access, and services that will help people with disabilities comply. But the guidance from CMS is very specific that Medicaid funds cannot be used for such supports. So this is connecting people with available services that are already available elsewhere, but not infusing new money into the system to increase the availability of those services. The state also has to take a special look at certain areas that have high unemployment or limited economic or job opportunities or limited public transportation to determine whether there should be additional exemptions from the work requirement to mitigate the impact on enrollees in those areas. And finally, there's language in the waiver approval that talks about the state's obligations to people with disabilities under the Americans with Disabilities Act and other federal laws. Talks about assessing their job opportunities, addressing those barriers, and providing supports and services and reasonable modifications to enable people with disabilities to comply. This slide sums up basically the four ways that you could lose coverage under Kentucky's waiver. Three of them are lockouts, and one is technically an eligibility suspension, but at the end of the day, they are all ways that you could end up losing coverage, even if you're otherwise eligible. So failing to meet the 80-hour per month work requirement will result in a suspension of eligibility until that is cured. And then the other three are lockouts up to 6 months for not paying premiums for people who are above poverty, and then for everyone for failure to report a change in circumstances and failure to timely renew eligibility. So the work requirement, as well as those other two lockouts for renewals and change reporting, are new for the first time. This slide gives you an idea of what some of the good cause and other exemptions are, and the main thing to take away here is that there are a number of exemptions, but they don't all completely line up among the different requirements. So you may have to do some sorting out as to which particular provision you didn't comply with and then figure out which exemptions you fall into. So in general, people who are determined medically frail, pregnant women, and people who are eligible as former foster care youth are exempt from these coverage loss provisions. And then there are a number of provisions that are having to do with medical reasons or health reasons or the death of an immediate family member living in the home that are common to a lot of the exemption or a lot of the lockout reasons. Notably, being evicted or being homeless is not on the list of good cause exemptions for the work requirement, although it does qualify as good cause for the other coverage lockouts. And again, there's specific exemptions for people with disabilities who either aren't able to comply as a result of their disability or needed and did not get a reasonable modification to a program policy and couldn't comply. This slide shows you some of the ways that you could potentially cure your lockout and so get back into coverage before waiting that full 6 months. And again, there are differences in what you need to do depending on the reason that led to your loss of coverage. So if you are disenrolled and locked out for failure to report a change or renew coverage on time, the waiver says that you need to attend a state-approved health or financial literacy course. And again, that's another area where more details about exactly what that looks like and how that will be implemented will be important to see. And then also importantly, I should note that using that course as a way to get back into coverage is only available once per year per lockout type. If you're locked out for failing to pay your premiums, you have to pay for the month to reactivate as well as attend one of those courses, and then you have to pay your back premiums if you incurred services in the time that you were locked out. And then for the work requirement, there's different things that you need to do depending on whether it's the first month after you didn't comply or a further month, but basically it involves coming back into compliance with your hours, and then the language in the waiver here talks about completing the state-approved health or financial literacy course as opposed to attending it. So we wanted to start wrapping up by talking about the litigation that was filed in Kentucky. This was filed January 24th by a group of about 15 Medicaid enrollees. They range in age from 20 to 62, and they are challenging the Kentucky waiver as a whole, some specific individual provisions, as well as the overall CMS work requirement policy. The case is currently titled Stewart versus Hargan, Hargan being the acting secretary, but we anticipate that that caption is going to change with the confirmation of the new HHS secretary. So basically, these Kentucky Medicaid enrollees are arguing that the Kentucky waiver and the work policy violates a number of federal laws, including the Administrative Procedures Act, federal Medicaid law, and then the president's constitutional duty to take care to faithfully execute the laws. And they say that these elements of the waiver put them at risk of losing coverage because they're creating new eligibility criteria, such as the work requirement, the premiums at 4% of income, the different lockouts, that are beyond Health and Human Services authority to promulgate under the Medicaid Act. They have sued Health and Human Services as well as CMS, and so while the federal agencies haven't yet responded to the complaint, their response isn't quite due yet. We do know from the work requirement policy, we can anticipate some of what their response will be because the policy and the Kentucky waiver approval set out why they think this is within their authority to do. So they've determined that the work requirement waivers do further Medicaid program objectives to the extent that they're designed to promote better mental, physical, or emotional health, or separately to help what they term as individuals and families rising out of poverty and attaining independence. They acknowledge that this is a shift in agency policy, but tie it back to what they call historic principles that emphasize work to promote health and well-being. So a response to the complaint is anticipated right now by March 27th. And in addition, other things to watch in the case are requests from the plaintiffs to certify the case as a class action. So it would be on behalf of all Kentucky Medicaid enrollees, not just the 15 named in the lawsuit, and also a request from the plaintiffs to issue a preliminary injunction, which would mean that the court would tell CMS to not and the state not to implement the waiver and the work requirement policy until the lawsuit is resolved. We also know that what we put here, approval of Indiana's waiver is imminent. We think it might be in the next hour, but very soon we also expect some changes in Indiana. So what's up in Indiana is an overall renewal of their program, so that their initial waiver was approved for 3 years from 2015 to 2018. So they're asking to have a lot of the elements reauthorized, and then they're also asking for some changes. So this slide shows you the basic structure, so premiums at 2% of income, a minimum of a dollar for those at the, you know, with no to very low income of 5% of poverty, and I should also say that that dollar minimum also applies in Kentucky, and having to pay a premium to first get coverage and then for people over poverty to stay in coverage and otherwise be subject to a lockout. Indiana also has a provision about testing co-pays of up to $25 for non-emergency use of the emergency room, and then this healthy behavior program, a waiver of non-emergency medical transportation, which is also true in Kentucky. And then right now they had a voluntary state-funded work referral program that was not officially part of the waiver. So key things to look for in the Indiana approval, in addition to renewing those above provisions, are an addition of a work requirement, which the state has requested. They've asked to move to premium tiers instead of a flat 2% of income, although CMS did issue a letter in December saying that they thought that that was okay within their existing waiver authority. Indiana has asked for a coverage lockout for people who don't timely renew eligibility, similar to what Kentucky has approved. And then Indiana has a request to be able to charge a 1% extra on premiums for tobacco users. So finally, finishing up, we've pulled together a list of key questions to ask as new waivers are proposed and approved. Everyone will be closely watching the litigation in Kentucky, although we don't expect, just like all federal litigation, we don't expect it to be moving terribly quickly. But I think what happens in that litigation could have ramifications for other states. There's been some talk about whether new flexibility in waivers, particularly being able to impose work requirements and higher premiums and other similar restrictive provisions might encourage non-expansion states to adopt the expansion, although, as you can see from the pending waivers now, we haven't seen any states coming in with new expansion proposals, but rather it's states with existing expansions that want to impose additional restrictions on their already enrolled populations. As waivers are proposed and approved, it's important to look at whether another state has already had experience with this and what the data show from that experience. For example, Robin had pointed out the data about the effects of in Kentucky about who's been disenrolled and for what reasons. Which populations are covered are important. We've made this distinction between restrictions on the expansion population as well as traditional populations in non-expansion states. So different populations could be subject to different requirements, and requirements can have different impacts, particularly on the very poorest people. Budget neutrality still applies, so the states and their applications should be estimating federal costs with and without the waiver, and to be approved under CMS policy, the waiver should not increase federal costs. The state's implementation plans are really key. As the slides indicate, these provisions are very complicated, and so taking into account what the administrative costs and challenges are is really important. We also wanted to flag the public input process, which was expanded under the ACA to have formal notice and comment periods, and then again, I had flagged those provisions in Kentucky where we may be seeing some more limited opportunities for public comment. And then finally, because the waivers are demonstrations, they will have formal evaluation components, or they should have formal evaluation components. And so those may take a bit of time. And so it will also be important to look at what we can learn from experience with the waivers before those evaluations are complete.
This is Chris again. Thank you, Mary Beth. Thank you, Robin. A very complex subject, but we've gotten some questions already, and I'm sure there are a lot more. I want to remind you that you can use the chat box on your computer on the web briefing screen to send in questions, and we'll get to as many as we can. I also want to let you know, again, that the web briefing and the slides are very important and very useful, as you can see. The archive recording and the slides will be posted on kff.org by tomorrow and perhaps as soon as later today. If you're on this briefing, you should get a notification when they've posted. Let's turn to some of your questions now. We've gotten several already about work requirements, and a couple from Allison and Sarah of AJMC Managed Markets, I think, have to do with Kentucky, so this might be one for Mary Beth. Allison asks, does the enrollee have to document his or her status each and every month? And she also asks, how does the state plan to accommodate rural areas? And I guess I would interpret that to say there may not be the same opportunities in some rural areas as in other areas.
Yes. So the waiver talks about documenting on a monthly basis. It also refers to the state's verification plan. So under the ACA, the states had to file plans with CMS about what documentation or electronic data sources, or in some instances, whether self-attestation would be allowed for different eligibility criteria. Kentucky's verification plan, not surprisingly, at least in the current version, doesn't speak to work requirements, because before, work requirements were never something that you had to verify to be eligible. So it's entirely possible that the state could update that plan, and we'll want to keep an eye on that. But right now, the closest thing in the plan is income, and income does need to actually be documented. You can't self-attest to income. So because of the language in the waiver, we're anticipating that there will be some sort of documentation. There are some people who won't have to verify on a monthly basis. If you are complying with the TANF or SNAP work requirement, they're going to consider you also in compliance for Medicaid. But this is another example of really important details that will make a big difference in how it's actually implemented that we'll have to keep an eye on. And then for the rural areas, the only language in the waiver is that obligation for the state to assess areas with, you know, limited public transportation, limited job opportunities. So, again, another area where more details will be really important as this is actually implemented.
Thanks a lot. Another question from Tim Murphy. I apologize, Tim. I don't know your affiliation. But Tim asks, do we know whether HIV disease will be considered a disability generally in terms of satisfying a work requirement or seeking an exemption? I don't know which of you is going to answer, but perhaps you should preface it by saying who's answering so people know.
Sure. Yeah. So this is Mary Beth, and I can take the disability question. So I'll just sound like a broken record now, but another area where operational details are going to be really important is how the state will determine what's called medical frailty. So there is a federal standard that says people who are medically frail are subject to various protections, and it becomes really important in Kentucky because it exempts you from a lot of these restrictive provisions like the work requirement and other lockouts. And so there's it talks about, you know, people with certain chronic diseases or medical limitations. I don't believe it specifically speaks to HIV. So there's a general federal standard. Again, how the state implements that is going to be really important, what that process looks like, how do you document or verify, and how long that exemption lasts. And also, my guess is it will probably depend on the extent of your functional limitations. You know, you could have someone with HIV where you're well controlled by treatment and, you know, essentially not having functional limitations, or you could have someone that whose functioning is impaired to the ability where it affects your ability to work. So I guess that's another open question, is whether the state will adopt something where it's just a straight diagnosis test, or whether there's going to be more of a functional test.
Thanks, Mary Beth. Maureen Gropp, and Maureen, I apologize if I'm butchering your name after all these years. Maureen asked two questions, and they're related. They're both a little bit big. Let's start with the first one. Maureen asks, can we describe any of the major differences between Kentucky's work requirements and those proposed in Indiana? And besides the work requirement that may or may not be announced today in Indiana, is the tobacco surcharge there another significant new element, and would that be the first in the country? And I'll get to Maureen's second question in a second.
This is Robin, and I guess I'll take this because it's a little bit of an easy answer because we don't really know yet. So I think we're going to have to look pretty carefully at the Indiana terms and conditions. We know that they are requesting a work requirement, so to condition Medicaid eligibility on work. And there was that guidance released on January 11th, so we're going to have to take a look to see when that's approved, how similar or different it is. We do know that in the on Figure 6, you could see that there, different states had different age exemptions for individuals. So in Indiana, in their proposed waiver, they would have an age exemption of 60 years. So anyone over 60 years would not be subject, whereas in Kentucky, that goes up to 65 years. And just to the other question, that the tobacco surcharge is something new that has not been approved in other states. So that would be something new. That would be the first time approval if that happens in Indiana.
Thanks, Robin. Maureen also asked, and this is a little bit broader than just the work requirements. She says one goal of Indiana's program, the Medicaid program, is to make Medicaid more similar to insurance that people get from their job, to make that transition smoother, I guess, getting back to work. So is that really the case with the way it's set up, both in their current waiver and what they're seeking now? Is it similar to job-based insurance?
Well, this is Robin again, and I'll let Mary Beth jump in. Certainly, paying premiums is often a feature that's part of employer insurance. I think they talk about the power accounts as being similar to these high deductible accounts that are often included, or these health savings accounts that may be included in employer coverage. But they really don't work very similar to health savings accounts that operate in employer coverage, because the state is really funding these accounts with contributions, you know, a set contribution from the state, as well as the premium contributions are what go into those power accounts. So that's very different than how, you know, a health savings account works in the private market, where it's funded as a set aside of your income. So I think the language is that they're modeling that, but the actual implementation of this account really functions much different. So I don't know if you have anything else to add.
Yeah, this is Mary Beth. The only thing I would add is there are certainly features in Kentucky that we don't see in private insurance. I think in my own private insurance and most people's, I don't have a penalty or get disenrolled if I don't report a change in my income within 10 days. So, you know, there are definitely some similarities, but some differences as well.
Thank you both. There's a couple sort of more process questions. One from Tammy Luby from CNN Money, who asks, well, was the Indiana waiver submitted after Vice President Pence became the Vice President and after Seema Verma joined CMS, or is it essentially their waiver? In other words, did they both pitch it and catch it, or is there some separation there? And then David Wahlberg of the Wisconsin State Journal asks us if you all have any idea when the work requirement waivers in Wisconsin and the other states that are waiting to hear, kind of over what period of time might that play out, if that's knowable at all.
Well, I guess there were a few iterations, this is Robin, of the Indiana changes. So there were, they had submitted an extension request in January, and then that was an update to an extension request that was submitted in May. The original waiver extension that was submitted in May did not include a work requirement. Or am I
other
switching?
Way, right. Switch. Yeah,
oh, the one
around.
In January
did
of
not.
Last year did not, and then the updated extension request in May did include a work requirement. So there's been some evolution in the and changes to what has been requested going, you know, as part of that waiver. In terms of timing, again, we're anticipating that Indiana will be later today. We don't really have a good sense of other states related to approval on the work requirements, but I do think it's important to highlight that work requirements are just one piece of what's often a much broader waiver. So, for example, we're also waiting for action for the waiver in Arkansas. But there are a number of other components that are pending in that waiver, so they're not really approving based on one issue. They, you know, CMS is reviewing the entirety of the waiver application.
And the timing of, in general, of approvals?
We don't know. We tried to time this webinar to not be in conflict with the Indiana approval,
yeah,
which we had anticipated to be as of the 31st, but we were clearly wrong about that.
I guess you don't want to run too long today.
Yeah.
So as you alluded to Arkansas, Robin. Andy Davis of the Arkansas Democrat Gazette asked if there have been any estimates of the fiscal impact of a partial Medicaid expansion. And is the cost of a waiver on other federal programs, like, I guess, the tax credits in the marketplaces, they have an unusual expansion there, usually a factor in deciding whether to approve a waiver?
I don't know if we have a definitive answer to that question, and the cost estimate for Arkansas may be different than what it would be if that provision were applied more nationally. Way back when the ACA was being debated as legislation, there were estimates that including individuals in the income range between 100 and 138% of the poverty level in private insurance or the marketplace coverage, again, nationally or as a choice relative to Medicaid, that was going to be more expensive for the federal government than increasing the Medicaid program up to that level. But again, on an individual state level, that there might be different estimates, and that is, you know, to the point about these various provisions, I think that is one of the issues that's very much pending at CMS about how to move forward. The last administration had issued guidance in the form of frequently asked questions that had, you know, told states that they would not be able to do these partial expansions up to 100% of the federal poverty level and still have access to the enhanced match. So, again, like work, this would be a reversal from guidance issued under the last administration.
Thanks again. So we have a staying in the work requirements lane. David Neal from WorkingJournalistPress.com has three questions. I'm going to try to condense them all. The first two deal with administrative costs, and he asks, are there studies on the increased cost for administration of work requirements? Are the increased costs, if there are increased costs, reimbursable under the federal match? David also asked specifically about Kansas and what are the work requirement conditions in Kansas's waiver application, especially in view of the fact that it's not a Medicaid expansion state. So basically, he's asking, are there increased administrative costs? How can they be funded if there are? And specifically for Kansas, what kind of work requirements conditions are in that waiver?
Well, this is Mary Beth. I can start off with the administrative costs. So we did the slide that talks about the lessons from TANF is from the paper that we did trying to look at what we do know about the effects of work requirements in public benefits programs. And so there are some administrative costs that are anticipated. Indiana, for example, had actually asked for a $90 per member per month payment to use federal Medicaid dollars. They had lumped together both administering the work requirement as well as providing some employment support, so it's kind of hard to know how that splits out. But then we also know subsequently from the CMS guidance that we don't anticipate that will be approved because they've indicated that's not an appropriate use of federal Medicaid funds. Other states did not include specific spending estimates, but did talk about the need to modify systems, come up with new processes for exemptions and verification, and tracking the various verifications and compliance. So administration is definitely a piece of this that's worth watching. I'm sorry, what was the rest of the?
Oh, Kansas.
Kansas specifically. So as you noted, Kansas is a non-expansion state, so we're really talking about low-income parents, which in Kansas goes up to 38% of poverty, so quite low. And they do not have an exemption for age, so some states had exempted people down to age 50 or 55, but Kansas does not do that, so it's all the way up to age 64. They have a caregiving exemption, and
to say a lot of these waivers related to work were submitted prior to the guidance that was released on January 11th, so it is possible that states could be working with CMS. You know, usually when a state submits a waiver, the final waiver approval is, you know, may look different than what was in the proposal. So my guess is that after the guidance, states may be re-looking at what they propose to see if they're in alignment with the guidance and might be working with CMS to make that happen.
Thanks. On the subject of waivers but not work requirements for a second, Leslie Small, Leslie, I'm afraid I don't have your affiliation. She asks, do we expect the Trump administration to approve waivers that implement the so-called partial Medicaid expansion? Now, we don't do predictions at the foundation, so I'm afraid we can't look into a crystal ball. But perhaps you could explain what a partial Medicaid expansion is.
Well, I think this was the issue that we were talking about related to Arkansas. So the Medicaid expansion as envisioned in the ACA was to provide Medicaid coverage to adults up to 138% of the federal poverty level. And in exchange for that coverage, states were eligible for a very enhanced match. So up to 100% for the first 3 years, and then it, you know, it gradually phases down to 90%. So in the last administration, there were a number of states that had said we really would like to do this expansion up to only 100% and then have other individuals enroll in marketplace coverage. The previous administration, again, issued this guidance that said that is not possible for states to do this, you know, quote, partial expansion up to 100% of the poverty level and still access that very enhanced match for that coverage. So this is an issue that's pending in waiver requests from Arkansas as well as Massachusetts. So that issue is, again, before CMS, and we would, you know, have no idea how, you know, would not be able to guess about how the administration will rule or react to those waivers.
Thanks, Robin. Steve Jordan, who's with the Omaha World Herald, asks if any states that didn't expand Medicaid under the ACA are applying for waivers, or will that not happen at all for states? I'm interpreting that to mean some states have expanded via waiver. Are there any states with pending waivers to do that? I know there are some non-expansion states that have other kinds of waivers pending.
Right. This is Meredith, and so that's one of the key things that we're noting if you kind of look at the slides is, I mean, it's entirely possible for a state that hasn't expanded now to come in and say, here's our waiver proposal, we'd like to implement a new expansion, and these are the elements that we'd like to see. We have not yet seen that. We have only seen states either with an existing expansion like Kentucky or non-expansion states like Kansas that are coming in with proposals to say, we would like to change our program in these ways to restrict coverage for people who are already enrolled.
I mean, that said, we are watching.
Yeah.
States are, you know, governors are putting out their proposed budgets, and there are a number of non-expansion states that had considered expansion in the past. So we will be watching what happens with state legislatures as they debate their upcoming sessions and budgets.
We have a little bit more time. If you have questions, you can still continue to send them in via chat, and we'll answer as many as we can. We're never far from work requirement questions, so let's get back to one of those. Linda Richmond from Psychiatric News asks, for people who have serious mental illnesses, will they be exempt from work requirements under the medical frailty clause? And how will it be determined which people with mental illness will be considered medically frail and therefore exempt? We're going to get all kinds of questions, not just today, but in the coming weeks about what counts towards exemption.
Yeah. So this is Mary Beth, and I actually have the reg pulled up in front of me now, so I can confirm that it does not have anything specific to HIV in it. With the last answer that I gave on this is accurate. So there's a general standard in the federal law about who is medically frail or otherwise has special medical needs, and the federal standard sets a floor. So it has to include what they describe as people with disabling mental disorders, including serious mental illness, chronic substance use disorders, serious and complex medical conditions, people with physical, intellectual, or developmental disabilities that significantly impair their ability to do activities of daily living, or people who are receiving federal SSI benefits. So you can see that a lot of those criteria have a lot of wiggle room. You know, it's a generally good standard, but it's very general. So how, you know, what qualifies as serious mental illness? What qualifies as a serious and complex medical condition? There's a lot of detail that the state is going to need to flesh out, both in terms of the substance of those decisions, what criteria are used, as well as the process for how you request and then ultimately get approved for an exemption.
Thanks, Mary Beth. We have a couple more questions about Indiana. Let's get to those. One is from James Ramoser from Inside Health Policy. And he asks, that's our technical questions. One, the work requirement in Indiana, would that apply to all able-bodied adults, not just adults in the expansion population? And does the elimination of non-emergency transportation apply to everyone or just in the expansion population?
Sure. So for Indiana, So Indiana's waiver is very complicated because it scoops up both their expansion as well as some of their traditional populations. So the big traditional population in Indiana is low-income parents. And again, this is all kind of speculative at this point because we're going to have to see what exactly the approval from CMS looks like.
And again, this was submitted prior to the guidance. So in the process of this submission to what might be approved later, there might have been some changes. Sorry.
Yes, that's a good point. From what they submitted to CMS, they talk about all non-disabled adults. So it looks like at least at the time when they applied, they were seeking for this to apply not just to the expansion adults, but also to the traditional low-income parents, which is consistent with what was approved in Kentucky.
There is this general use of the term able-bodied, so we can refer you also back to Figure 10 that shows among Medicaid enrollees who don't qualify on the basis of disability. Again, most are working, and then the large majority after that face all of these various barriers to work. That many of them cite an illness or a disability, but would be in this group of probably what would be considered able-bodied adults. And then the following slide that shows that, you know, the large majority of Medicaid adults that have a disability, in fact, are not qualifying on the basis of disability, but they may be qualifying based on income. So, again, these are all individuals that could be subject to the work requirements. They could also be eligible for some exemption, but would have to navigate that process to get the exemption.
So we've got a few more questions and a little bit more time. James from Inside Health Policy also asks, how significant is the proposed expansion of substance abuse treatment services in the Indiana waiver? Is this a common peg in these waiver requests?
So we are seeing a lot of state interest in particularly in waiving the federal IMD payment exclusion. So to clarify what that jargon means is federal Medicaid law says that you can't use Medicaid dollars to fund services for non-elderly adults in a particular type of institution called an institution for mental disease, which is obviously an antiquated term. And so the idea was that they wanted to preserve the state funding pre-Medicaid that was going to inpatient behavioral health treatment. Given particularly the opioid epidemic, we're seeing an uptick in states wanting to have that payment exclusion waived, so to be able to treat people, particularly for short-term detox, in these institutional settings. And so the Obama administration had issued guidance allowing states to do this and approve some waivers. The Trump administration has approved a couple more waivers. Kentucky is the most recent, and Indiana has a similar proposal to be able to use Medicaid dollars to pay for these short-term stays. One thing that's important to note is, and this was really emphasized in the Obama guidance, less prominent in the Trump version of the guidance, is what the entire continuum of care looks like for people with substance use and mental health treatment needs. And so it does look like in Indiana's proposal, they were going to include some additional community-based services, including peer recovery supports and relapse prevention outpatient services, in addition to expanding the inpatient detox services. But in terms of a state's obligations under the Americans with Disabilities Act, separate and apart from the Medicaid Act, it's important to look at whether there's sufficient continuum of care in the community as well as in an institution.
So we're closing in on an hour now. Let's take a couple more questions, and I'm afraid we'll have to wrap it up, but you all know where to find us if you have more questions. Staying with Indiana, Maureen from Gannett asked, what's our take on the most recent stats about how many people left the Indiana Medicaid program for various reasons? I know there was some reporting recently about people dropping out for non-payment premiums. Maureen asks, is this more or less than expected? Does it confirm what we've found in our earlier work looking at this at the Indiana program and Michigan's?
Yeah, I think we are planning on digging into some of this data. These quarterly reports for Indiana were just posted yesterday, so we scanned through them and looked at the distribution of reasons for closures for the third quarter. And again, that data is presented on figure 9. And of those closures, we're seeing that nearly 3 in 10 were due to failure to comply or to complete a redetermination, and 7% were due to failure to pay into the account. I do think there's some other data that's not shown in terms of closures, but was in their evaluation report produced by the Lewin Group that showed that thousands of people who are eligible and are determined eligible for coverage never make that first premium payment. So that's another whole group of people that don't show up in this closure numbers, but never actually get enrolled in coverage because, again, they're not making that that payment. I think the report refers to them as, you know, there's leavers and never takers because they because of that other requirement to make a payment first, which, again, is not part of how you would apply under the traditional Medicaid program.
This will have to be the last question. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. This is still in the Indiana vein. Indiana's on everyone's mind today. Allison and Sarah from AJMC Managed Markets asks, we mentioned Indiana charging $25 for using the emergency room for non-emergency situations. How will they determine non-emergency or expect enrollees to do so, especially if they don't have access to regular care and a particular condition they have flares up? Thoughts?
Again, this is some data that the state is tracking in terms of emergency utilization in their quarterly reports. They do show that there's a range in the claims that are deemed non-emergent, ranging from, you know, about 17.5% to 23%. But my guess is that they need to do that based on the claims after someone is out of the emergency room. And it is hard to make that determination when someone comes into the emergency room because often people come in and don't know if their condition is emergent or non-emergent.
Yeah, this is Mary Beth. The only thing I would add to that is there's actually an operational protocol for how this works, and it's another example of how, you know, the devil is really in the details of these things and how these operational protocols really matter. So in the protocol, it says that if the person calls their health plan's nurse hotline before going, they'll be exempt from the copay regardless of whether it's ultimately determined emergent or non-emergent. And then the provider makes a determination based on, you know, would a reasonable person think this is an symptoms give rise to an emergency. And then there's another decision on the back end on the claim. So there's multiple decisions, including, you know, some with the benefit of hindsight, that can make that determination.
Okay, I think we're going to have to wrap it up. Thank you, Mary Beth. Thank you, Robin. Thanks, everyone, for taking the time to join us. If you didn't hear it the first two times I mentioned it, the web briefing, an archive recording of it will be posted online by tomorrow morning. You should get a notification of it if you were on this briefing. If we didn't get to your question, feel free to contact me at my email address, which is pretty easy, clee@kff.org. It's up on the screen, and we'll see if we can get you an answer. There are additional resources that you may find helpful that we've compiled here on the slide. Feel free to visit our website to take a look at them. Again, thanks everyone for coming, and I'm sure we'll be in touch with many of you as soon as later today. I should mention one last thing. Somebody alluded to it earlier, but apparently there have been reports that there'll be a press conference between new HHS Secretary Azar and the Indiana governor to make an announcement at 2:30 today. So I imagine most of you are turning your attention to that. Thanks again for your time.